Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 4, Episode 25 of Cinematica. 25?
We're almost... Oh my gosh, we're going to move on to...
Season 5, nearly.
I'm going to be away for the first episode of Season 5.
Oh no.
But I will be here for the closer of Season 4.
Well, look, it's all just too exciting, really. The fact that this roller coaster ride that we've been on continues is... It's kind of amazing, really.
Yeah, think a bit about of a relief.
Yeah, and also I think we're nearly at the 2-year mark as well.
Oh my gosh. You know,
so
we are.
Yeah. Just flown by.
How can you be at season 4 and only into the second?
Because we do American television style 26 episode seasons.
Okay. I just had to ask.
Yeah, fair enough. So you will have heard several voices with me here in the studio. My name is Dan Slevin, and on the far side of the room,
it's me.
And joining us for this as a special guest reviewer from the Dominion Post in Wellington, Mr. Graham Tuckett. Graham.
Hi, how are you?
We're very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here. Simon has decided that he's been poorly this week and hasn't seen many films and has decided that discretion is probably the better part of valour for this afternoon.
I woke up this morning with a wicked cold, so...
Well, you're doing well so far.
Yeah, I've been keeping hydrated, taking vitamins, so...
There's actually nothing better to take your mind off being crook than being live on a podcast like this, you know? Mm-hmm. It's great. Mm-hmm. The time will just fly by. In today's episode, are your kids bouncing off the walls with frustration because it's school holiday time? Well, of course, you're going to take them to the movies, aren't you? Why not let Cinematica guide you towards the most age-appropriate entertainment for your little ones? We will also feature an extract from the special Lighthouse Cinema Q&A with Lloyd Jones, the author of the novel Mr. Pip. That happened on Monday night. We'll be playing an extract of that a little bit later on. If you want to hear the whole thing, that will be available as a special Cinematica extra, which will be downloadable in a day or two. But yeah, you get a sneak preview later on. But first, what is in the mailbag? We've been getting some two-word reviews from people, haven't we?
We have indeed. From Man of 100 Words, a good friend of Cinematica, two-word review for Gravity, Cinematic Asphyxiation, and the guys over at Flix cannot say enough positive things about Gravity. I'm really
Next week we're doing Gravity.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so many retweets this week.
Yeah, that's me probably. Nice.
Robert Caddo's two-word review for The Turning, 3 hours, 17 directors, one interval, Astonishing Straliana, or Wondrous Winton, but dark.
Yeah, and The Turning doesn't arrive in New Zealand until November, but they've made a few screenings available to select people. Graham and I saw that on Monday morning.
What did you guys think?
I loved it.
Yes, actually, yes, loved it. I know you've had time to settle with it, haven't you? Because that was not your first response.
Well, I mean, I didn't. Firstly, I've read the book and I absolutely adore the book, and I've found it's not always quite so difficult to separate your experience of reading a book from your experience of seeing a film, because normally they stick a little bit closer together. But because the book is like 17, about 12 of the 17 short stories are quite definitively linked and could have been a single feature. So I thought putting them into 17 different short films with different casts playing the same characters, I found really disassociating at first. Mm. But with hindsight, I've decided I did love it after all.
Yeah, I think I agree. It felt to me, not having read the book, that it's actually the way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I needed 48 hours to separate it from... Oh, I forgot. I was going to read the book in for you. I needed 48 hours to sort of separate what I thought of the book from what I thought of the film. But as a standalone film, it's a real good.
Hmm. The Mirko tweeted his two-word review of Blanca Nieves, Snow White. That is such a good two-word review.
Oh, look, our listeners are way better at these two-word reviews than we are.
They have time to think about it, though. They go home and wonder, you know?
Yeah. And also, speaking of that black and white wonder film, Adzabil said, I assume Blanca Nieves, because the silent bit and talked to her, was Almodovar Silencio.
Mm.
That little whooshing noise is that going right up my head.
I've got one here for Turbo from my friend Che Tibby on Twitter, and his little boy, who's known on Twitter as Chef Du Plunge. So I did ask for their two-word review of Turbo, and apparently it's go Turbo, go Zoom.
Nice.
You're down tooting.
And
hyphens.
Look, I can see across the way there that you've got the stats for the weekend, so you can tell us what New Zealanders were going to see this weekend, the first weekend of the school holidays.
And school holidays were ruling at the box office. In number 5, down from 1, The Smurfs 2. Entering at number 4 is Turbo. Down to 3 from 2, Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters. At 2... up from 3 is Rush, and in the number 1 position is Planes.
Oh, so Rush has actually done well in its second week.
Yes.
That's good news. Was that you?
No. That music means it's time to turn the page.
I'm terribly sorry. I thought that was on silent.
That's right. It's not like Radio New Zealand where you actually crash the plane if you've got your phone on in the studio.
Somebody feeling sorry for me being left out of their Twitter stream. They're texting me two-word reviews. Oh.
So let's get into the school holiday stuff. And I, you know, just want to point out that the idea of basically two 40-something-year-olds trying to discuss what's appropriate for school-aged children is kind of bizarre, really, if you think about it. So we're going to... I mean, a lot of this... You know, the closest person in age to the target market around this table is Kaylee, because...
Thanks.
By about 20 years, right? So, you know, we're going to be deferring to you in, you know, quite a lot in this discussion. First, a film that should have had Pixar's name on it, but rather wisely they didn't.
For the first time, we have a crop duster in the race.
Well, he's gonna die.
Dusty, you're going up against the best racers in the world.
I'm afraid of heights.
That airplane needs some help. Y'all know that, right?
Yeah!
It ain't how fast you're flying, it's how you fly fast.
You can fly a whole lot higher than you think.
Ballistic!
He's ready.
Hey, look who made it. It's Rusty.
Dusty. Dusty Crop Hopper.
Farm boy.
Yes, apparently, in inhabiting the same world, the same universe as Pixar's Cars and Cars 2, this is Planes 3D. Although Pixar doesn't have their name on it, it's just a Disney movie. And so I don't know to what extent the Pixar studio actually was responsible for putting it out. Kaylee, any ideas?
No, but somebody told me that this was originally a direct-to-video.
You know
idea?
What? That does not surprise me in any way, shape, or form.
And I have a feeling it may have come out of one of the Disney studios that is responsible for straight-to-video.
For the direct-to-video, uh-huh. Right. Well, you can also tell, because if you look at the voice cast on Planes, it's the B-list voice cast, isn't
Dean
it?
Cook. Dean Cook, and no one can stand his voice or comedy anymore, and now...
I know, and he's the only one who gets his name above the title. You know, even John Cleese... is relegated to you know.
See, now you're showing your 40-something English and English fucker papa is the fact that anybody else who was saw Planes even knew who John Cleese was.
Yes,
except possibly you, me, and arguably Kaylee.
Exactly, and I also recognise Stacey Keach in that voice cast again. So, yeah.
But another thing.
The words slumming it really leapt to mind there.
Another thing I learned was that they did regional voicing for the female character, that apparently, also this rumor I heard, that in the Australian New Zealand release, the love interest has an Australian New Zealand accent, and in America she has a Texan accent.
Oh, I thought that I looked at the plane, and did they repaint the plane as well? Because it sort of looked golden green. The Australian,
because I didn't think there was anything overtly Australian about that character. I mean, she wasn't. I was going to say something in appalling taste there, in a way. I mean, you're right. There was no sort of golden green or references to the Southern Cross or a bad Amelia Earhart puns or anything going on.
No,
so.
That wouldn't surprise me. Naked sort of pandering to marketing, yeah. I guess, going on there. We should just give you a quick rundown of the plot of this film. Dane Cook plays a crop dusting a plane in some small town that looks very, very much like the town that
Cars came out of.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. It's like they're reusing the backgrounds. It's like the old Disney animation.
Well, the old Hanna-Barbera. They just keep on running past the same bit of Monument Valley over and over again.
That's right.
I love that.
Well, it makes perfect sense in this digital world. And he has dreams of something bigger. There's a round the world air race that he's desperate to take part in.
Stop me if you heard this before.
He manages to get himself into that race, and then he becomes the underdog as they travel around the world. And of course, sure enough, you know, he overcomes all of those obstacles. It is very much the same old, isn't it? And it's there's no question that it should have been a director video. And somebody realised there was probably a few quid in it from sort of garrulous kids who, you know, I mean, Cars 2 wasn't a very good film, and that still made pots and pots of money because the kids do love those sort of animated machine creature things with the googly eyes. They just love them.
Yeah, and it's repetition for them. It's something that they recognize and they already like, and so it's, you know.
Exactly.
They enjoy it.
There was one section of that film that... there were a couple of sections of that film where I thought the animation was particularly good. One was the opening dream sequence with the Top Gun plans, and where they've done a really good job of sort of recreating a lot of the sort of Top Gun angles and the Top Gun shots. I thought that was quite good, and I was also really quite taken with the trip to India in that. So
do you have two words?
Well, I was. Graham's been taking notes there, and he's got. He might have several suggestions.
This is the exact film reviewer's equivalent of doing your homework at 8:30 in the morning on the bus on the way to school. Look, I hated this thing with an absolute vengeance. Yeah. I have not loathed and detested a film as much as I loathed and detested Planes, I think, in years. And I stand here as a fan of Cars, and I didn't absolutely hate Cars 2 quite as much as I might have said I did in the paper. I did have to go and see it again a few weeks later to please an 8-year-old, and I thought, oh, maybe I was a bit harsh on it, but Planes is just drivel. It's as though somebody's written a very, very simple and basic computer program called Spit Out Child's Cack, and which is now it's the one about the little underdog who challenges his elders and betters and superiors, and somehow through nothing but force of willpower manages to win. I mean, the irony is we're going to be talking about Turbo in a minute, which is exactly the same script done really well, and I thought Planes, it was lazy, it was derivative, but most kids' films are lazy and derivative. Kids are idiots, they've got no idea what they're watching. You show them something shiny and colourful that moves fast, and anyone under the age of 7 will go, oh great, can I have some more sugar? I'd really like Dylan Moran on that when he says, children, they're just midget drunks, and you go, yes, you're actually not that far off. And this is why, you know, obviously, anyway. But I thought Planes delved into some incredibly not even stereotype characterizations, because these things haven't been stereotypes for 30, 40 years now.
Yes.
But there's an African-American character in Planes who's like there's Dusty's crop-dusting mate, who is like one very, very small step ahead and only just from Uncle Remus in Song of the South. It is an appalling character. Just this, he's voiced as African-American, but he's clearly dim. He wants nothing more but to work in the fields for the rest of his life, and he doesn't understand why this little, small, enthusiastic and obviously European-derived plane wants to go on and make better of himself. And I found that a hideously offensive stereotype. I could deal with the Bhutanese and the Indian stereotyping, because that seemed to be sort of affectionate and playful.
The Mexican one was pretty foul as well.
The Mexican one was one step away from a mariachi band. It was just awful.
And they even brought a mariachi band out to sing Love Machine.
Yes, because that's what Mexicans do. Yes. They stand underneath
the Australian
women's windows and serenade them with mariachi band. But speaking of the women, the two female characters in it were straight out of I Dream of Jeannie. These were 1950s sitcom female characters. They had no reason to exist other than to be objects of the male gaze, and their only point of the whole plot was to be seduced and won by a couple of the male leads.
Except for the mechanic, who was female, who was
they saw us coming and they went, better chuck a chick in there with some sort of the fact they didn't actually write her as lesbian is about the only thing I'll say in that film's favour, and they only did that to keep their PG rating. I loathed this film, I really did.
Yep.
I agree with you about the fact that some of the animation was reasonably visually attractive, but look, a 12 year old with a laptop can make a decent animation now, and I think a 12 year old with a laptop did.
Yep, I don't doubt that for a moment. Now, you've managed to insult
Everybody.
Pretty much. And and not least the kids who might be wanting to go and see the film.
Yeah.
Like, this is what sort of age group do you think this is sort of pitched at? Eight?
I would say 85 and over. Look, it's pitched at 6 to 9, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, because the one thing about this particular school holidays, which I think is much more clearly defined than they have in the past, is that all of the four films that we're going to talk about have a slightly different age band that they're being aimed at. I think
I would have said with Planes and Turbo, we were probably in exactly the same band.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But but that's arguable.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, two words, Graham.
Utter cack
from Graham, and mine would be just air.
It's almost a pun there. It's good.
You could feel me searching for it, couldn't you? And I couldn't quite
circling the pun.
couldn't quite make it happen. Anyway, couldn't
quite get on the tail of it and bring it down.
You could say crop duster because
true bull dust. You haven't seen it, and you did a better two-word review than me. I mean, that's outrageous.
That's because she's so closer to being a child herself.
Deep in the woods, there's a village filled with joyful and happy Smurfs.
Okay, narrator Smurf, that'll do.
Oh, all right. But not too far away, the evil wizard Gargamel is up to something diabolical.
I am making my own creations to help me finally capture the Smurfs. I will call them the Naughties.
Where are we?
It worked. Close enough.
Okay, Smurfs 2, Hank Azaria as the evil wizard Gargamel.
Buck teeth are so awful.
Is that Hank Azaria?
Yeah.
Oh, see, there's a star right there.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's full of stars. Christina Ricci is one of the voices in this one. She plays one of the naughties. And
she plays the only other female Smurf.
Katy Perry, Brendan Gleeson, Neil Patrick Harris.
Neil Patrick Harris returning from the first film.
Right.
And also this got close to provoking some tears in me for good reasons throughout the film, and then it sort of pushed me over the edge was a really lovely dedication at the end to Jonathan Winters, who played Papa Smurf and was one of the great Hollywood comedians of all time, and who passed away after the film was completed. And you know, Jonathan Winters was the guy who people like Robin Williams looked up to and wanted to be, you know. So just a fantastic talent. And it was like, oh, yeah, this film, it feels to me like this film has got a great heart to it. Totally unexpected. You know, I thought the first one was kind of disposable. It was a way to sell Smurf toys. And not only Smurf toys, but the Sony product placement in the first film was everywhere. I mean, there's a lot of it in this one as well. But for some reason, this film actually works on multiple levels. So, I mean, Kaylee, what did you think?
I did not see the first one because I did watch the Smurfs cartoon a little bit when I was a kid, but it always creeped me out a bit. It was always a bit, I don't know, there's something just weird about it and, just a bit off.
There is something weird about it. It's European. You know, it's different.
It's very different.
Belgian. Isn't it Belgian?
It is. It's full of Belge. Yes.
Yes. I went into this thinking I would really dislike it, and it was such a surprise to me that I actually enjoyed it, and I teared up a few times close to the end.
So you're the third person I've spoken to, otherwise apparently sane, and Daniel Slevin to my left is the other, plus a random person I met in a cafe in Wellington yesterday, who's told me that they were close to tears watching Smurfs 2.
There's so many things. There's like father-son issues, there's
adoption issues, identity issues, family, just a whole lot of really good stuff about the family you choose versus the family that you're born into.
Somebody has slipped bloody drugs in the popcorn butter is the only explanation for this. I'm going to go and see this thing this afternoon just out of sheer
Look,
intellectual curiosity.
And I told you yesterday as well that there is a scene between Brendan Gleeson as Neil Patrick Harris's stepfather, who wasn't in the first film, who's just like turned up in this one. Right. And when he turned up, I thought, well, that's just like a sort of random rewriting of history to make casting sense, isn't it?
You know? Haven't rewritten the Smurfs creation myth.
No, this is the Neil Patrick Harris creation
myth. Before you know it, there'll be a second female character, and then the world will end.
No, but there's a whole backstory around why there's only one female Smurf, and so that's because she's not an actual Smurf. She was Smurfette was created by Gargamel to infiltrate the Smurf village so that he could then... capture the Smurfs, because what he needs is their essence.
So it's sort of a Judeo-Christian Satan in the Garden sort of myth.
I don't know if I would go that far, but it's interesting. Like his magic, the magic that he uses in his wand, comes from Smurf essence, which basically involves squeezing them like blueberries. Doesn't it? You know, that's what he really needs. He's got a machine that he wants. He needs as many Smurfs as possible. It's quite horrible what he wants to do to them.
It is.
And if he wasn't such an idiot,
did you say he wants to squeeze them like blueberries?
Basically,
We're taking our children to see this.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is.
Come here, little Smurf. I'm going to squeeze you like a blueberry.
There are stakes in this film, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
This is fabulous. I can't wait. Yeah. I've in my contract with the Dominion Post, and when I started off 7 years ago now, I said no torture porn. Like, I don't have to review Saw 6 or any of that, because you just go, they're not really films, they're made for people that certainly don't read the paper, and I just refuse. So I don't do torture porn. I also said no Smurfs. I'm officially I am Smurfphobic. Those little blue bastards just give me the shits. I really don't like them one little bit.
Well, all I'm going to recommend to you is that you don't have to do this for work. Right. Do this for fun.
I'll have to go and see Smurfs too, for intellectual curiosity.
There are still some strange issues with it, like the fact that Smurfette is the only female in this whole male world, and they do have her as a very harlot-y sex symbol voice as well, with Katy Perry. Yeah.
And there are several, lots of the Smurfs have crushes on her.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a bit weird.
Well, it's predominantly a Catholic country. I mean, nothing's to it.
And it starts out with her being admired, and like, she's up literally sort of on this pedestal,
and her blonde hair waves in the wind,
and she jumps into the water, and it's just like,
ooh. One step away from being chained in a basement and even a sex slave, basically.
In Smurf terms,
Smurf world, anything better than being squeezed like a blueberry.
So, look, we won't delve too much further into the plot,
into the politics of Smurfism,
except that I want to come back to Hank Azaria, because, you know, I think a seriously underrated character actor.
Yeah.
And he is... This is not one of those films where you get the feeling that a comic actor has just been let to riff, you know, or improvise their way through it. It is all pretty tightly scripted, I think. He's not just making stuff up.
He's not Jim Carrey.
No, he's not Jim Carrey, and he's not...
See, there's another star right there. Already it's a two-star review, and I haven't seen it.
Yeah, and actually... Or everything automatically gets a half star for not having Gerard Butler in it. So that's
another half star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So look at how we're way ahead.
I'm handing out half stars for not having Brad Pitt at the moment, which isn't that many films, but...
true. So we've got the Smurfs too. We've managed to persuade Graham to at least park his prejudice.
It's worth seeing it for Gleeson as a duck.
Yes.
All the duck work is amazing.
Yeah. Well, one of my favourite ever Brendan Gleeson cameos, he plays a womble in Breakfast on Pluto.
Right.
Yeah. I thought that was Brendan Gleeson, wasn't it?
I think you're right.
Finish up on YouTube. Yep. Yeah, right. No, that was. I think Brendan Gleeson as a duck, I'm in.
Good
yeah.
stuff.
Right.
All right. And so do we think we have two words for the Smurfs too? Did you see it in 3D, by the way?
No, I didn't.
Not important. Absolutely not important. I saw it in 3D, and there was hardly any 3D necessary moments in it. Whereas it's not, you can't say that for every film. Sometimes they really do come to life a little bit, but this one doesn't matter.
No.
So
my two words for the Smurfs 2 are is blue surprise.
And my two words for the Smurfs 2 this time around are actually good.
Mine will be intriguing.
Thanks. Excellent. And we love it when people give us two words and they haven't seen the film, because they're just about, they're no less accurate than ours.
That's two for two now today.
Indeed. Okay, time for some news.
What's French for faux pas? I think it's le faux pas. Thanks, Dan.
You were actually saying
the marketing team responsible for promoting the Diana biopic made an embarrassing misstep when they put a poster advertising the movie outside the tunnel where her car crashed 16 years ago. Serious. Worse, it was also in sight of the Flame of Liberty that has become a sort of Diana memorial in the years since the poster has been taken down.
Yeah, and an apology has been issued.
I think they should have put it outside the Mercedes showrooms. That would have been really good. Sorry.
Or been sponsored by Mercedes.
Okay.
Good news and bad news for
Hamilton. I wonder if they're going to have one hanging on Harrods. A Diana poster.
I think, like, well, definitely they should be some product placement involved.
There'll certainly be some sort of tie-in, wouldn't
there? Yeah, I would surely say so. Mind you, that film has been panned so unmercifully by the British media.
Apparently Naomi Watts plays Diana as some sort of delusional dingbat, and I don't see how that could possibly
insult anybody.
Oh, gosh. Moving on. Good news and bad news for Hamilton movie fans. The new Hoyts complex in Hamilton is promising to be the first multiplex to ban disruptive moviegoers.
But the bad news is you still live in Hamilton.
Oh, please. We have listeners in Hamilton, I think, in the single figures. So
I tongue a defender from Hamilton. I'm allowed to.
Yep.
Latecomers will not be admitted, and texters and talkers will be asked to leave, according to the Plex management. The Waikato Times is also reporting that a secret agreement, not so secret, signed between Hoyts and their Center Place landlords prevents any expansion of the rival art house cinema, The Lido, which has three screens on site and has been trying to add to that ever since Event Cinemas closed there 18 months ago. That is horrible.
I know.
Stink. Richard is such a nice guy.
Stink buzz. So, so while one new outfit looks like they're trying to do the right thing by moviegoers. Certainly, there's no latecomers.
Right.
That's great.
So this is the nice little three-screen art house. Well, I love the word art house, but anyway, art house cinema next door won't be allowed to expand.
No.
Correct.
No. Even though there's room.
Because Hoyts have signed a lease with the same landlord.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's almost kind of, surely that's, was it restraint of competition or something?
Yeah.
Thing that's illegal if you've got enough money to employ a lawyer?
Well, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. It's not great. It's not great for Hamilton audiences either. And I think that, you know, it just leaves a bit of a sour taste, doesn't it? Because the Lido, certainly in Auckland and in Hamilton as well, they're just one of the great independent operators. They have just a fantastic facility.
Speaking of somebody who grew up in Hamilton, I grew up in the time of the Carlton and the Regent, and there was certainly nothing to see. I mean, your options there on a Friday night were to go to a really bad film or start a family. And the idea that at least there's a three-screen art house cinema in Hamilton cheers me up greatly.
Yeah, well, exactly, and I think there's still the Victoria. Might still be operating as a single screen in Hamilton as well. They're actually not too badly served for big screen entertainment now, because there's that big Te Rapa complex, which has got like a super screen there as well. So
my car ever breaks down on the way to Auckland, I might go and have a look. But that's the only thing that's going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. You try and avoid actually turning your ignition off just in case you can't get started again.
It's the Palmerston North of the North.
And now, if we've got any North Island listeners left, it's time to for the petrol heads.
In the North Island? Hamilton?
Yeah.
There you go.
Something for you guys.
My name is Turbo. I just wanted to go a little faster.
Slow down for a second.
Are you kidding? Again.
With my brains and your speed, we should be destined for greatness.
The Indy 500.
This is ridiculous. A snail cannot race in a competition meant for cars.
Wow. Aren't you just a little ray of sunshine?
Ryan Reynolds, and we were talking just before before we came on air that you didn't Graham, you didn't recognise that voice, and but now that you know it's Ryan Reynolds, you can hear it. Hey?
Yeah,
you
no, I was so busy weeping with emotion that I missed the first couple of seconds of the credits, and I didn't spot that it was Ryan Reynolds. Oh. I spotted Paul Giamatti immediately, and I spotted Richard Jenkins really fast as well. Yeah. And I was hoping that it was Snoop Dogg because it sounded exactly like Snoop Dogg.
Snoop Lion,
and it was Snoop Dogg, so I was happy about that. But I didn't spot Ryan Reynolds. And he's got a generic voice, and he doesn't get all the films that Ryan Gosling gets now anyway. So
true, and Canadian. So I will hand over to our Canadian correspondent for
Canadian and race your open wheeler.
You're basically our motorsport correspondent.
Yes, probably. I feel so cool now. Turbo, about a snail who is in love with Indy 500 racing, specifically this one race car driver. Whose name escapes me right now, but it's voiced by the incredible
French Guy.
Something really, really French.
Gagné.
Gagné.
It was Guy Gagné.
Yeah.
I slept through most of this film. How do I remember that?
Who played Guy Gagné? Who was that?
That was the amazing Bill Hader.
Okay.
Whose voice, every time I hear his voice, I don't recognize it, and then
he genuinely is a protean.
He is incredible.
Character, yeah.
I love Bill Hader. And he just recently finished his run on SNL, and it just like broke my heart. And also another Saturday Night Live alumni, we have the voice of Maya Rudolph, who I adore, from Bridesmaids.
Oh, yeah, true.
Oh, yes.
She was the sassy lady snail. So we have Turbo, who wants to be, who loves the Indy 500 and wants to live a exciting, fast-paced life, but unfortunately does not because he's a snail, but in an amazing blending of Nos and his blood becomes a super fast snail.
It's like Peter Parker being bitten by a radioactive spider.
That's exactly what it looked like.
Exactly what it was.
Yeah.
It was the scriptwriters get out of jail. We'll just genetically program them to do something
different. With nitrous.
Nitrous oxide. All those little platelets lining up. I love it.
And snails have hearts and more than just ganglion.
And teeth.
So he becomes a super fast snail and is discovered by one half of a taco team, taco slinging team.
Yeah. The Hernandez Los Bros.
And in a very elegant comparison with Planes in terms of the ethnicity of the various characters involved, this one celebrates the diversity of
despite the fact that they're morbidly obese and they ran a taco stand. Somehow this was an inoffensive stereotype that slipped past me and without so much as a blink, and I enjoyed the characterization.
Yes, and Luis Guzman. Yeah. Yes, and the elderly Asian woman who ran a nail place in a strip mall. You know, voiced by,
and was some sort of a dragon granny, but at the same time
exactly. We're all just so forgiving, aren't we?
Yeah.
Forgiving mood.
If you do this stuff with wit, you get away with mountains of potential offensiveness. Mm. As long as you're witty and big-hearted to start with.
Yeah. Yes. And so, like we said, much like Planes, it's about the small guy who wants to go beyond his boundaries and what other people think and go on to succeed and do bigger things. And it is just so much fun and so cute. And someone actually came with me to watch it, so that helped too. I wasn't by myself.
You got a date?
I got two dates for films this week.
Wow. Mm. Things are looking up.
I know. I got to watch High Fidelity with a date. It was amazing.
That's right, because the Roxy are really going all in on their archive screenings, aren't they? You should check out the Roxy website, actually.
Because I think there's almost one a week.
Yeah. And maybe sometimes more than that as well. And often on 35mm, they're trumpeting the fact that these films
still have a projector.
Yeah. And so, High Fidelity was one. And, it's lots. They're just thick and fast, those archive screenings.
Good for them. Mm. Mm. See, Hamilton, this is what you're missing out on.
Yeah. And it's great because it's on a Sunday night. You don't have anything to do. Yeah. Go watch a film. Mm. Beautiful cinema. Awesome.
So, Graham, Turbo, you were super excited.
I love this. Look, it's everything that Planes wasn't. It's virtually identical story. It's about the little guy that decides to take on a race that he can't possibly win, and of course he wins. But
no spoilers.
No spoilers. Of course he wins. He's going to win. You know, like there hasn't been a film, and there hasn't been an animated movie in which the hero doesn't win, with the notable exception of Cars. didn't Cars, he sort of gave it away at the last moment and said, no, it's for the greater good, I'll sacrifice something or other?
Look, that does ring a bell, but I don't remember.
They decided he was the winner
well.
After all. Anyway, what I'm saying is like, it's not a spoiler.
But this isn't just about animation. This is just like kids' movies generally.
This because, like, firstly, I think it satirizes the whole genre. I mean, this is not, your average seven-year-old isn't going to be sitting there and going, oh, what a telling satire. But it was...
Self-referential.
But I love the fact they said, what's the most ridiculous flipping thing in the world that can happen? They said, right, let's have a snail enter the Indy 500. But you're rooting for this snail. You just go, look, you can do it because you've been genetically modified, you're getting sucked into the intake of a boy racer in the first 12 minutes of the film. And it all just sounds so stupidly over the top that it can only be a satire of the genre, but other than, a crop duster taking on jet planes is ridiculous, whereas a snail taking on the Indy 500 is...
Oh, perfectly valid.
Well, it's into the realms of... Of sort of Gilliam-esque fantasy. I just enjoyed it, and it looks a million bucks. The characterizations are fantastic. The vocal lineup is
Samuel L. Jackson's
just
in it.
Stellar. Samuel L. Jackson,
as
Snoop Dogg, Richard
snail.
Jenkins, Louis Guzman's. Yes, Samuel L. Jackson is the badass black snail. Again, a stereotype that passed me completely by. If he'd pulled out a gun at some point and said, "Say what again, Melon Farmer?" I would have been delighted. I just liked everything about this movie. I thought it was it's everything that Planes wasn't, despite the fact that on the surface, to read them both on a piece of paper, these are 80% identical screenplays and plots. But when it's everything is in the application.
Execution dependent is the phrase that they use in Hollywood now.
Everything is in the heart and the wit that you bring to your project. Mm. Like, the projects are virtually identical. One is done with heart and wit and generosity of spirit, and the other one is done with one eye on the cash register and the other one
on the lunch boxes. Yeah. Exactly. But it's not just that, as we discussed a little bit earlier on. Before we came to air about Smurfs, it's also about the amount of attention you pay to the detail in a script, and that don't be afraid to just hand it to somebody else and say, look, can you just do some more jokes? Can you do puns, and can you do slapstick, and can, give it a pass for all of these things to really amp up all of the things that it has to do to work, because these films they're manufactured to a degree, but at the same time, they have to. They can't bore their life out of the parents who are taking their kids. They've got whole families of kids to appeal to and not bore. So they've got to have something for everybody almost simultaneously.
If I had the time and went this afternoon to see Turbo again and to see Planes again, Turbo, I know I would spot little references and visual gags that I was oblivious to the first time, little puns, little vocal inflections that I hadn't caught that would delight me anew. If I went to see Planes again, there'd be nothing there.
Yeah,
that is. It's the sticker on the cover of the lunchbox. That's all that movie is.
Right. Two words. Should we go around the table?
I also noticed your notes there by Turbo that they actually reference social media really well.
Yes.
Yeah, and it was so. And the
Turbo
other thing
actually
Turbo
existed
so...
in the 21st century.
Yeah.
It referenced YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, but did it not in a sort of khaki or let's have a modern joke way, but in a way that this
actually drove the
racing snail becomes a social media sensation as he would, and it did it accurately.
Hmm. Yeah,
and really catchy YouTube's track. Isn't it?
Actually, the music. Yes, there was some music in there, and we shall come back to that later on. So, two words.
Oh. I don't know. Can I have a minute?
You can go last. But look, I'll tell you a little story. I went to see this yesterday afternoon, and I fell asleep through a fairly crucial part of the of that. So it wasn't until
your lack of professionalism.
So speaks the person who turned up. How late were you for
30 minutes?
Yeah. So I had to watch the trailer to find out about the nitrous. Stuff. I had no idea how he got his secret powers, and I also had to ask you today how it is, like, whether the human beings could understand him talking or not, because I had no idea what was going
it's
on.
It's like Brian the dog in Family Guy. Again. Yeah. Can, who knows that he... I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so unfortunately, for not keeping me awake during the absolute crucial plot side of this film, I'm going to have to say snail snooze.
Yeah, but it was a snail. You snoozed. I think.
Yeah,
that's, yeah,
yeah.
But I'm going with a good solid 4 stars.
Four
school holiday delight, and 2-word review. Deceptively perspicacious.
Ooh, blimey! Talking about overheads.
Yeah.
So now we're giving you enough time.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Magical Mollusk.
Oh, it didn't work on that at all, did you?
No, I just like, what did they call him in the film?
Oh, so it was yeah. So were you just
from the dialogue.
Actually, no, I like what the pun they use in the film. snailed it. I like that. You probably slept through that one as well.
Yeah, I did. I expect. Right. Good work, everybody. Okay, okay. One more, and I'm the only one that's seen it, so this one I'll go quick.
Aren't we missing One Direction? Aren't we reviewing that this week?
Did you see One Direction?
No, but Rudy is really looking forward to your review.
All right. I don't have any audio for One Direction, but I will.
Could you sing some?
No, because before I saw the One Direction movie, I was completely unfamiliar with their oeuvre, shall we say.
Oh, you're so lucky.
I knew that such a band existed because they'd been to Wellington last year. And you know how we're talking about lunchbox commercial cynicism on planes. Oh. The fact that when One Direction walked off stage at the St. James in Wellington and immediately tickets for their next concert went on sale, you know, like a year later,
yeah,
because nobody could trust that anybody would still remember them if they left it any later than that. Yeah. You know, so these manufactured X Factory's Got Talent sort of Simon Cowell productions, they're a conveyor belt, and whereas if you think about.
But it's the essence of pop music is to be disposable.
Well, yes, I mean, and
the disposable pop bands that happen to sort of stick around after 5 years because of an accident of history, or that did happen to have some great songwriting talent behind them.
Yeah, but then there's a natural lifespan of these things, and then there's a sort of conscious use them up, spit them out.
Yes,
about the cow phenomenon, which gets correct. Me. If you think about Colonel Tom Parker, and you know he basically stuck with Elvis till long after Elvis was dead. You know, like it was one manager doing a job of exploiting one artist for as long as was
doing a
as
job
possible.
Of exploiting.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
He never actually successfully invented another artist, so he had to keep on milking that cow for 40 consecutive years.
Yeah, so is that cow's great talent the fact that he's able to
every
keep sort of finding
a,
new
every
ones?
Every year has a new cow.
Well, that's a depressing thought,
that
isn't
is
it?
Depressing
but
thought.
The film, Dan.
The film. Okay.
Or the
anyway.
Movie.
All right. So, the so these five chaps, they're amiable enough.
Yeah.
They're working class. They know precisely how lucky they are.
Yeah.
And they're traveling the world. They're having a great time. They know their limitations. Like they know that they're absolutely shithouse dancers and don't even bother rehearsing that side of things very much.
Good for them.
But yeah, well, exactly. In terms of them,
that's part of their brand, is their shithouse dancers.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I've got no beef with those guys. Yeah.
They're British, aren't they? Not American.
They're British. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
there's
British
a
star and Irish.
Straight away. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was interesting looking at the sort of machine that rolls around behind them, in that you know the process of recording their album, the new album, while they're on tour, basically involves. A sort of Svengali-like producer sitting in a hotel room making the music, writing the songs, doing all the backing tracks, and then getting them out of bed to record a vocal. They put mattresses up against the wall and stick a microphone in the corner, and they just do several takes of the vocal, and then they go back to bed again, and then he calls the next one in to do his version. They've got no input whatsoever into the music or the choice of songs or any of that sort of stuff.
Well,
so you know, and that may change at some point. But I suspect that reading between the lines of the conversation between these guys is that they know that this is about as good as it's ever going to get for them, and if they can turn it into
college fund.
Yeah, a college fund or so. Or, you know, they'll never have to go back and work in the bakery or the factory ever again.
All I know about them is that a 13-year-old girl of my acquaintance said, I wasn't into them 6 months ago, which I thought was genius. As in, when she was like 11 and a half, they were her favourite band. Now that she's 12 and a half, going on 13, no. And I thought, well, there's your lifespan.
Mm.
Like these are the fruit flies of the pop world.
Yeah.
But I did see them on Graham Norton, probably a couple of months ago now, called Graham Norton on a Friday night. One Direction were five of his guests. And I just sat there thinking, what a remarkably pleasant, well-mannered, grounded, self-aware bunch of kids. And I just wish them well.
Yeah, well,
and also Morgan Spurlock
made the documentary, and this is a perfectly probably the first paying gig he's ever had, because he's self-funded everything else that he's ever done. Yeah. I think.
Although Super Size Me must have made him a dollar or two, surely.
I expect so, but he said
but
he would
have paid
all
the medical bills,
and he would have plowed all that money back into
to pay for the liver transplant after he finished making. But I do, I mean, I like Morgan Spurlock as a filmmaker. He's got a genuine sense of humour.
From a purely cinematic point of view, I guess. So for Rudy's benefit, the problem that this film has isn't so much that the characters aren't engaging and that it's pleasant enough to follow them around, but there's no drama.
Right.
Like,
nothing. There's no stakes.
There's nothing at stake.
It's not like the Katy Perry documentary where she gets dumped.
No, Katy Perry divorces in the middle of hers, and that's a pretty crucial.
That was a remarkably moving film. Wasn't it? So, yeah, she was going through this horrible, bitter, knockdown, drag out divorce.
Exactly.
While the film was being made.
And Justin Bieber, the whole film is all about the nodes on his vocal cords and will he be able to play Madison Square Garden?
Honestly going to be, will his testicles descend on camera?
But seriously, the whole of the Justin Bieber film, they keep going back to doctors and x-rays and stuff being stuck down his throat. And it's like, will he be able to play? Will he be able to play Madison Square Garden? And of course he does, right? And then, of course, my favourite of all of these concert movies is the Iron Maiden one.
Right.
Where the most dramatic moment in the entire film is where Nico McBrain...
Are you talking about Flight 666?
Flight 666,
That film made an Iron Maiden fan of me. I always thought they were a metal joke at the end of that movie and went, I love this band.
I loved it too. And Nico McBrain, the drummer, gets hit on the wrist with a golf ball in Costa Rica, he may not be able to play the gig that night. So, all of these films, right? They need something, and this One Direction film has none of it.
This is a sign of maturity in rock and roll: is when you've gone from drowning on somebody else's vomit in a Rolls Royce in a swimming pool to I got hit on the wrist with a golf ball. you've got through. You're a survivor.
Yeah, precisely. All right. Okay. So I hope, Rudy, I can tick that box. I don't ever have to go back to One Direction. Thank you very much.
Good for you.
Percy Jackson.
I learned that the gods of Olympus are real. And sometimes they have children with humans called half-bloods. We're pretty much like anyone else you'd meet. But with a few notable differences. We live in the only place that is safe for our kind. Until now.
The only thing that has the power to save our home is the Golden Fleece. It's in a sea of monsters, what the humans call the Bermuda Triangle.
Our quest calls for only our finest hero, the best of us.
Does that character sound on the edge of tears the whole film?
Look, all I can tell you about Percy Jackson... Here's the thing, I'm the only one that's seen this film.
And Jason and the Golden Fleece.
The success of the books comes from the fact that they've basically taken an ordinary American teenage kid and dropped him into this world of Greek mythology. And
also, it's actually supposed to be a ripoff of Greek mythology.
That's the whole point. Well, Percy Jackson himself is a half. He's a son of Perseus.
Percy Jackson.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
And. But hold on, haven't you both seen the first one?
Yeah, no, I have seen the first one. It's 3 years back now.
Yeah, I know, I couldn't remember any of it either. So they do a fairly good job of assuming that you haven't seen the first one
given the target audience for these films, I mean, to them 3 years is, you know, aeons.
Exactly.
That's like half their lifetime.
Well, you've gone from being the right age for the film to being too old for the film in three years.
Yes.
I mean, you've gone from 12 to 15.
Which you could say about the cast as well, actually, because, a little bit like Harry Potter in that, you know, those kids aged. They did a reasonable job in Harry Potter of trying to sort of suppress how old those kids had actually gotten.
There's a really good, you know, the sort of Paul McCartney is dead type.
They put them on hormone therapy.
What do you call them? Conspiracy theory floating around the interweb that Daniel Radcliffe actually was replaced at some point. And the original Daniel Radcliffe was either paid an awful lot of money to keep quiet or killed. Because the J.K. Rowling franchise could not possibly have this kid who actually got spots. The first ever conspiracy theory I know that involves somebody being assassinated for acne.
You know, and I think that story is infinitely more interesting than the film that we're actually about to talk about. Yeah,
right, cool.
Look, this is... there's just strikingly uncharismatic lead actors... characters that really don't have that are not terribly interesting, and a whole Greek god mythology that doesn't appear to make very much sense. I was really surprised that there was a second one. You know, we've seen the Mortal Instruments this year, which was set up to be a franchise and has failed.
Is there never going to be a second one?
No, looks like they've already turned the tap off on the money for that one.
I quite enjoy Mortal Instruments.
Did you?
I sat there loving the fact that it wasn't Twilight. And just knowing that I could yet again write another review in the Dom Post to do nothing except generate as much hate mail as I possibly could from the Twilight fans, and I succeeded.
Yeah, well I mean, good for you for your trolling.
But I thought it was competently made. I like that. And the female character got to actually do something rather than mope about which boy she was going to not have sex with.
For me, the film that I give thanks for that isn't Twilight is The Hunger Games, and actually that's going to be turning up a little bit later on, and actually turns out to be quite good, you know. So let's give thanks for that. So anyway, there's really not
definition
much
of the word good you'll find in the dictionary that Dan owns.
The
books are right.
No, I thought the film was right, and certainly I have to say that the trailer for The Hunger Games is often the most exciting thing that I see whenever I go to the movies. You know, like
including the actual film.
You must have seen
the Lego trailer
several times.
I want to see the Lego movie. That just looked fantastic. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's good. Yeah. Do we have it? Is it on the whiteboard here, Kaylee?
It isn't on the whiteboard here.
Yeah.
But if we consult Flex, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. The best thing I've seen at the multiplex in the last 3 or 4 weeks is the Lego trailer.
It is a bit like that, isn't it?
I downloaded it on YouTube the other day just to show it to somebody. You know, I usually do that with like obscure Jackson 5 clips. It was like I showed them the Lego clip.
All right, two words for Percy Jackson.
We haven't talked about the film at all.
No, because let's just wrap this sucker up. Because all I can say is inoffensive.
Drivel.
Yeah, it's not drivel so much, but it is inoffensiveness. That's all. You know, one word. Anyway, so that's our school holiday roundup. If you don't know, if you haven't got an idea about what to take your kids to this school holidays, and in fact, even if you don't have kids, go and see Smurfs.
Go and see Turbo.
Do a double feature.
Do a Turbo.
I don't know if I'd recommend feature. Doing both in one day.
Yeah, actually, that's a real bad idea. Maybe one day after the other.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like do spread them out, because otherwise the you'll go into toxic shock from all the sugar.
Oh, the sweetness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the cuteness and like the talking.
Ooh. Indeed.
See, Turbo above all that, I found.
All right, time to just go get a little bit grown up for a moment or two. On Monday night at the Lighthouse Cinema on Cuba Street, Wigan Street in Wellington, we had a special advance screening of Mr. Pip, the new New Zealand movie adaptation of Lloyd Jones's novel that opens on Thursday around the country. Lloyd Jones, the novelist, happens to live pretty locally, and he turned up after the film for a Q&A. We recorded it. You can hear the whole thing as a special Cinematica extra a little bit later on. But for now, here's a couple of questions and answers from that Q&A just to give you a taster. There was a round of applause at the end of the credits rolling, and you missed that, unfortunately. So perhaps you would like to do that again.
Well, thank you. But I'm not the filmmaker. I'm just the representative of the filmmaker.
Well, and we're very glad to have you here. But let's be honest, the film wouldn't exist, would it, if you hadn't had the spark of inspiration to begin with. So let's start with that. Where did Mr. Pip, the literary, where was the genesis of that idea?
Okay. You can't believe how many times I've been asked that question.
Well, then you'll have a really...
No, but and I don't mean to be impolite. You've probably... Many of you may have heard about the genesis of Mr. Pip before. I feel like I've said it so many times. But really, it goes right back to 1989, 1990. And it was... you would have seen the newsreel on the film there when the blockade was imposed by PNG. Well, in the Evening Post, there was just a one paragraph describing this blockade, and I was completely intrigued. One, I'd never heard of Bougainville, and it didn't sound like a very Pacific a name for the Pacific. And I was just completely captured by the notion of a blockade of an island just being kind of roped off like that, and I anticipated the worst happening, and indeed the worst did. And so I endeavoured to go there, and I actually I wrote a long article for the Sydney Morning Herald. I didn't actually get to Bougainville on that particular trip. I subsequently did, but on that particular trip, I was taking a boat from Leh across to Rabaul. And it was an overnight boat. And in the wheelhouse of that boat, there was a PNG defense officer drinking beer. And I went into the wheelhouse, and as the night went on, he got more and more drunk and proceeded to tell me how they were taking the rebels out to sea, dropping them out to sea, and dropping them over the forests of Bougainville. And so I wrote – I couldn't write this in front of him. I kept ducking into the toilet to write down notes and spent a lot of time in the toilet. And anyway, wrote my story. And in Australia, actually, it was quite a big deal because the helicopters that the PNG Defence Force were using were Australian Iroquois helicopters. So, you know, there was repercussions, political repercussions there. Yeah. So, look, it was just a response, a journalistic response at the time. And then I think what happens with all writers is that you save landscapes and situations. They go into some sort of bank of memory. And when I began to write it, what I was writing about around 2005-06, Bougainville just surfaced at that particular point.
And the rationale behind introducing a Westerner, a white guy, into that environment, was that to sort of just make it easy to provide that outsider's perspective on what was going on?
A rationale. Rationality doesn't come into writing. That's in the film world where everything's got to be stitched together and in a very logistical way. No, it just happened. I had this image of a white guy towing a black woman behind in a cart, and I was intrigued by that image. Where did that come from? Who saw that? Well, suddenly the voice of the person who saw that was Matilda. That came to me almost instantaneously as I recognized where this place was, Bougainville. And so there was a whole – what I'd been working on was this notion that and it's actually in the film there, a Pākehā guy is married to a Polynesian woman and they're decorating this room for their unborn child. And that room is supposed to be a metaphor for the new Pacific, where the child will pick and choose in terms of mythology and ancestry and belief systems. But I set myself a task that was a little bit too difficult in some respects because I forgot about narrative. And but nonetheless, as soon as Matilda's voice came to me, I, you know, the whole thing just became invested in this place, and you got the undercurrent of the war and all that kind of thing. So it all came alive very, very, very quickly and surprisingly.
It seems kind of obvious now that it's an amazingly cinematic place, location, environment, situation. Was Andrew Adamson the first person to approach you to talk about adapting it for cinema?
No. Casarotto, the agents for film in London, were the ones handling the sale of the film, and they put the word out and got a lot of interest and a short list of three or four directors. And I remember Casarotto rang me, or Charlotte Kelly rang me in Berlin. I was living in Berlin at the time. She said, "You have to talk to these directors. They're going to ring you and they're going to be pitching." I said, "I really don't want to do that. Can't you take that phone call?" "No, no, you have to." Awful business. I sat up there late at night in Berlin, and Andrew was last. And I was completely captivated by what he had to say and also his own story. I mean, he had grown up in PNG. He had said that he'd met any number of people who reminded him of Mr. Watts. He was fluent in Pidgin. And when I said, "Look, the film has to be shot there and using local people," he didn't flinch, so I thought that was a good sign.
His background as a director, you presumably were familiar with the likes of Shrek and Narnia and what have you.
Yeah.
Neither of those series of projects lend themselves automatically to this sort of thing.
No, they don't. But And I did think of that. but I got the sense that, in a way, it was somebody who was squaring off his creative side with where he had grown up. There was a sort of a paying homage, because his uncle, I think it was his uncle or his great uncle, was a missionary in Bougainville, and he grew up, of course, he spent about 10 years, I think, in PNG. So there was a sort of a, it was an opportunity to revisit his formative years, his childhood years, via this film.
There's always a major transition from one form to another when you go from literature to cinema. How close, or how much did you care about what ended up on the screen, or were you content for him to take it and make it his own?
Yeah, I made no creative demands or claims whatsoever. I feel that if you've bought the rights to the film, you've bought the right to reimagine. But as it turned out, he was remarkably faithful to the book, and they very cunningly made me the script consultant, so that in situations like this tonight, I won't complain. But it was a good conversation, actually. He read the book very intelligently. The only difference of opinion we had was over the imaginative scope of Matilda imagining Dickensian England. And one of the things about a screenplay is it's not really a literary document. It's kind of like a manual. And there's nothing seductive or enchanting about a screenplay. So it's very difficult for somebody who's not familiar with that kind of language or the way that a film is locked down into a screenplay to see what the director sees. But he was able to see, obviously, he was very familiar with this form. But there was just these little areas that I couldn't see what he could see as a director. But it was all perfectly civilized, you know.
Lloyd Jones at the Lighthouse Cinema, Wigan Street in Wellington. That is our show for this week, ladies and gentlemen. Next week, we'll be reviewing Mr. Pip, of course, as well as Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, Adrift in Space in Gravity. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. Simon will be back, I'm sure, because I know that he has seen Gravity and will want to contribute, and he's seen Mr. Pip as well. So it's not often that we get him here having seen two films in 1 week. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. Leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Those ratings, reviews, they help push us up the ladder and help more people discover the show. You can contact us through several different mediums.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter via @CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd, where you can find our 2-word reviews. We are there as Cinematica, and as always on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music. This is some people I've never heard of before called V12 and Nomadic. And apparently this is called The Snail is Fast the Turbo movie.
No.
Until next week, that is all from me. Thanks very much, Graham, for sitting in on the show. It's been a pleasure having you
here. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
And I will see you next week. Mr. Snail on the racetrack. I take that, hit the gas, it never fails. Love the speed going fast. Headed right past you. Winner of the race, Turbo Snail. Yep, that's who. So buckle up, do your thing. No one on the track ever expects him to win. Look at him, Turbo. Fast, you slow, you don't get past. You see him gaining position, but first he won't be last. He's ready to make a dash, snail quicker than a lightning flash.